Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Sam Wong. Sam is a principal at BMW iVentures. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Christian. Pleasure to be here for this lovely afternoon.
You know, it's gorgeous outside, and super excited to get your perspective and share it with our audience. So I think maybe we can infer, but I don't like guessing, so I'm going to ask. Let's start with BMW iVentures. What's the investment thesis?
All right. So as preface, we're a 300 million euro fund on Fund 2 that invests on behalf of BMW. We invest in areas that include auto, sustainability, manufacturing, supply chain, enterprise SaaS, and a lot of AI stuff. Series A and B primarily. We've been around for over 10 years. Fund structure. And it's been a fun ride. I've been here since Fund One, so over 8 years. So I know the team, and I know the company fairly well right now.
Wow. Okay. So wide scope. I presume not limited to the United States. What are you currently bullish on, and where you're looking?
Yeah, not limited to the U.S. So U.S., Europe, plus Israel. I am bullish on. This is my personal bullishness on. Okay. Kind of two camps. One is just general AI. I mean, we've seen an explosion of AI stuff, and now there's like a plethora of new use cases that AI enables. So I'm heavily looking into that. And then also there's this whole new kind of, you know, onshoring movement and just general like push to add automation and drive efficiencies across the factory and manufacturing environments. So I'm heavily looking at the whole factory space manufacturing, which also includes a bunch of robot stuff too.
Well, if we could start with AI, so I'll oversimplify it and put them into two categories, co-pilots and agents. Do you draw a distinction? And if so, which one do you find yourself leaning more towards?
Well, definitely agents. I mean, like, they're kind of along the same flavor, right? Co-pilots assist and agents can like kind of automate the workflow. I think there's tremendous opportunities in both of them. But when you say agents, it kind of more closely aligns to like vertical SaaS powered by AI. And I think that's kind of a very fruitful area. And then I would say this whole generative AI boom is very, very cool. But I also don't want to forget the old AI stuff, which is like the predictive, like machine learning methods, which also can be the fruit of many great companies. So Gen AI and like old machine learning based AI, both very cool areas for investment.
I agree. And, you know, it's interesting. So when you guys you're investing not a little bit later on, not pre-seed, but, you know, what are some of the milestones or evidence that you guys use during the due diligence process to make a decision of whether or not you're going to cut a check?
Yeah, I mean, it depends if you're hardware or software, right? So software, we want to see good ARR growth, like 3x, maybe even more, right? With all these AI companies hitting like 100 million ARR in a few years, you could have even faster growth than like the traditional 3x framework, which is what a lot of SaaS investors held themselves to. And then I would say for Series A, where we play, 2 million ARR is now kind of like the new benchmark we want to see. I think before, like a few years ago, it used to be 1 million ARR and then you can raise money. But now investors are a lot more disciplined and they want to see a lot more growth. So 2 million ARR is what we're looking at. If you're a hardware company, you're not going to be held to the same SaaS metrics, but I want to see product market fit, and that's often evidenced by customer expansion and then talking to customers. So it just depends on, you know, which flavor you are, hardware or software, but all we want to see is good product market fit, good growth, amazing team.
I'm curious on the higher threshold of ARR, how much of that do you think is just because it could be easier to achieve the milestone versus a higher interest rate environment that's requiring investors to be a bit more cautious?
Oh, I think it's a mix of both. We saw the higher interest rates go up, and we saw, and then that resulted in, slowdown in LP funding, and then more disciplined VCs reacting to that. And so when they make a bet, they want to see higher ARR. But also, it's so much easier to get to, 2 million ARR now, right? Like, you can have the one man driven AI company. So it's, I think this whole new playbook is being changed as we speak.
Interesting. I have a bunch more questions on the phone, but before I do, can we take a step back? I'd love to hear what your career progression looked like leading up to BMW.
I will give you the honest career progression story, Christian, which was I was an academic before I thought I was going to be a professor in history. I was in a Stanford PhD history program, and then I was like, crap, I don't want to live in the middle of nowhere. And you know what? I think I want to make a little bit more money than a history professor would probably make getting out of a 7 to 9 year PhD program. So I sold my soul, went to law school at Berkeley, then realized in the midst of a Google internship where I gained a lot of weight, but learned a lot about life, that I didn't see myself doing the whole legal path for my whole career. And so I interned at Bosch Ventures when I was in law school. And then that thankfully led to kind of a career in venture because, once you get your foot in, it's so much easier to walk to the next opportunity. So that's kind of my career progression. I found venture capital as a something that fit me personally because of the intellectual component of it, but also like the networking and social part of it. They kind of married both worlds. But I would say, I don't think I had to have a very linear path. But that's called life, right? You figure it out as you go. And I think that I needed that iteration so that I kind of could finally realize that this is really the role and the path that I feel most stimulated by intellectually.
And the irony of it is too, is like my opinion is that these unorthodox paths, yield a lot of benefits because you gain perspective that other not everyone else has and puts you in the minority. And I think it at the end of the day makes you a better investor.
I hope so. I see my when I was in a history archives for like 10 hours a day, I can see some of that diligence skills being ported over. But I like to tell myself that I didn't waste my life back then. So that's maybe a comforting story to self-soothe.
I'm curious, what period of history were you focused on?
19th, early 20th century, U.S. United States.
Yes. Okay. I presume there's overlap with the Industrial Revolution there.
Oh yeah, that was a big driver of a lot of change and in society. So definitely touched on some of the Industrial Revolution stuff in my work as well.
I can't help but imagine, even if it was subconsciously, that there's parallels that you may be picking up on with artificial intelligence today. It's just fascinating subject to think about how the world is on the precipice of massive change, and I still don't think that most people appreciate it.
Oh yeah, I don't want to bore you because I can talk your ear off on like historical changes and technology changes. But yeah, AI is just one more cycle of technological development, and society has experienced numerous technological cycles, right? Like birth of the phone, internet, right? And then now it's like AI. Wow, it's a kind of a crazy, crazy time to be alive, I would say.
100% agreed. And then on the legal front, did you ever end up practicing?
No, I passed the bar because I'm I guess a little sadistic. But yeah, I still use some of the legal skills at my workplace. So it's helpful, but do you need to go to law school to be a VC? No, I would say not.
Okay. And then, I also understand, as if you didn't already had enough to do as an investor in BMW, you also carve out some time with two other projects of yours, the Asian Tech Collective and the Investor Table. Would love to learn more about those as well.
Yeah, so VC, your life as a VC, it will depend on how strong your network is, right? Because that's where you get deal flow, that's where you meet people, right? And so a few years ago, I was like, I really got to invest in my network, right? And so I started a couple of organizations with a great group of people, mainly friends and VCs. One is Investors Table. It's a networking org that's centered around millennial VCs. We have chapters live in San Francisco and New York City. And it's just a great community that we started literally in the pandemic. We were, meeting at people's houses, and now we're actually meeting in like different at the SVB Experience Center, later on like different accelerators, right? So it's been a great community. And then the other organization that I helped found was the Asian Tech Collective. So it's a nonprofit that is centered on building community across Asians in tech, specifically senior leaders across the tech LPs, VCs, and founders. And you can think of us as like the crazy rich Asians of the tech world. And it's really around creating community because the ecosystem is very tight-knit. And this is one of the most reciprocating and wonderful group of people. But then also there is a like a kind of a mission to give back because we're all Asian American and we're all living in this world. And so even though we're in tech, I serve on the board of the Asian Law Caucus, which is the oldest civil rights group representing Asian Americans. My goal is to give back. So with Asian Tech Collective, it's events first, community first, but I wanted to use it as a channel to helping all Asian Americans, not just those in tech. So those are two of the things that are close to my heart, apart from the Asian Law Caucus, which is a really awesome org that I'm on the board of, but those are the big ones that I would share today.
Awesome. Wow. Let me ask, for anyone who's listening, any key takeaways this many years in, having started those organizations you'd like to share, as you've learned over your time in?
I think Christian, you kind of get it because you've been building this podcast and you've been, taking a like a give first mentality, right? I would say if you want to network well and if you want to build strong connections, put yourself last, put other people first, give people, more than what you could give yourself, right? And so by prioritizing other people, making sure that they're happy, I think your network will grow a lot. And that's what I do with these organizations. It's really about putting others first and making sure that the community experience is a good experience. And it's, focused on their experiences. So this is for maybe VCs are typically me first. I think that's the wrong way. It should always be others first to network effectively.
Yeah, there's definitely some law in the universe that it says it comes back to you in spades. Even if someone had to ask the question, well, what's in it for me? But it's also extremely gratifying to help each other, help other people. I agree, especially when you have the means to do so.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's studies saying that generosity makes you live longer. So you should probably do that. You should probably give back.
Well, that, and I think it's just this idea of community. I think when people, at least in my experience, when I feel like I'm part of something bigger, it reinforces purpose. Not that I necessarily need it because I got a very long list of things to do, but I definitely have had moments where I've stopped and I said, oh, if actually someone else who's a stakeholder in what we're building has benefited from this introduction, and I didn't get anything out of it, but just knowing that, they're a little bit further along than they were before.
Yeah, it just makes you feel good. It's a little fuzzy, that little fuzzy feeling, a little dopamine kick you get when someone gets helped out by you, right? I think that's a good feeling. And karma is a real thing, right? If you're a dick in the industry, you're not gonna go very far. Or maybe you'll go very far, but I don't know how you'll be living or feeling at your deathbed. So this is my approach. I don't know if everyone is this way though.
You could probably devote an entire episode to karma and
Probably.
karma. Okay, let's come back to BMW iVentures. And so let's due diligence. What does the process look like for the fund?
So, pretty typical for like a financial VC firm, probably like 6 to 8 weeks of diligence. I scour across all of the main areas of questioning of a startup, right? Is their product market fit? Is there growth? How's the founding team? What are their credentials? Do I think they're the team to execute and win? What's the market like? How what are the market drivers? What is the big opportunity? So, you know, I'm just going down my list of things that I need to make sure a company follows and looks like before I get excited, given the stage of the investment and the amount of risk we want to take at that specific juncture.
Any characteristics that you found or patterns that have jumped out at you over the years when you look at profiles of companies, whether it's the tech, the founders, the market, of what lends itself to higher probability of success?
I like to look at areas where people don't tend to look, because you can make some interesting bets, and you're, it's not as competitive. And there's often I look at spaces where no one plays, right? And there's no other digital or other technology that can support that. So, yeah, I like to look where no one's looking. But in terms of criteria, I wouldn't say there's any like special criteria that is different that we use from other VCs, but we got to make sure that the company looks good across all of the buckets from founder, product market fit, value prop, all of the above.
Okay. So investment is made. What's the degree that BMW is going to get involved with supporting portfolio companies?
Yeah, we have a great director of platforms who sits in BMW, and she, her responsibility is to take our portfolio companies and make intros to BMW, as well as our network of other tier ones, other autos, et cetera. And then we also help with capital fundraising. If you're raising a next round, we have an extensive network across the United States and Europe that we can make intros to, also make intros to customers. Also, we provide board level support for lead investors. For lead investments, we typically take a board seat. So we try to be hands-on and very supportive throughout the life of the company.
So, it's interesting, and this may be limited to my experience, but when I talk to a lot of founders, they don't necessarily realize that there's this thing, a corporate venture capital fund. We've now had the opportunity to have a handful of CVCs on the podcast. Thank you again for joining us. But obviously, you bring with your investing proudness, but also this relationship with this large corporation. What are some of the bigger benefits that you see, and why you would encourage founders to seek out a corporate investor at your time with BMW?
Well, first off, our brand, it carries a lot of weight, right? So if you have a corporate on your cap table, it's a signal to the market that you're a legitimate company, and that there is probably value add to your product for your customer because that corporate invested. A corporate can also make a lot of intros and also help you grow within an organization. It's tough to grow at a big organization and sell into a big company like BMW because we're huge, right? So we really helped you take that handheld approach to get the right intros across the organization. And so you can get the right stakeholders pushing you throughout the organization. And so I think CVCs, there's a whole range of different CVCs. We structure ourselves like a financial. And so you kind of have to be judicious in what CVC partner you select, right? You should always aim for more financial oriented, clean terms. But corporates can add a lot of value, and often that's brand legitimacy, intros, and also we have a strong network across not only our corporate stakeholders, but also our complete VC network too. So don't take CVCs lightly. They can be very, very helpful entities for the growth of a company.
And I couldn't agree with you more. If I was a founder, I think I'd seek out a CVC if I can find one who I thought may Great sense for all the reasons that you outlined. That said, you also point out there are a lot of CVCs, and some of them I've picked up on is that they have different investing mandates. Some have, just free rein. Hey, if you find an opportunity that you think will generate return, great. Others have been very strategic, and only will invest if it supports a larger corporation. Where does BMW fall?
We're definitely along the more financial lines, right? So the way that I like to position ourselves is that we are a financial firm, but we invest in areas that are strategic to BMW. And there's been a lot of research done on this whole topic. If you are a CVC, if you want to maintain your life and sustain yourself over the very many vicissitudes of a corporate, of your mother company's kind of changes, it's really best to be on the financial side. So we're thankfully more on the financial side.
Okay. All right. So coming back to earlier conversations about ask when I asked which you were bullish, one of the things you talked about robotics, or at least personally, you were bullish on robotics, and also supply chains and the nearshoring that's taking place. Anything that's kind of triggering that, or do you see any more macro themes that are playing out globally that are really got you honed in on that thesis?
So what we found is that for a lot of the robotic plays that are doing very well, they're competing with an in, or they're competing with often what would have been manual labor done by humans. What's happening across organizations from their supply chain to everything is that they're lacking people. There's a huge labor shortage problem. It's affecting a lot of the blue collar work. A lot of the areas that roboticists are trying to automate away. That could be like welding, or that could be finishing and polishing for an airplane surface, right? So all of these things that would have been historically done by humans and are also like very taxing on the body. I'm looking at solutions that could enable that because there's just this huge labor shortage problem. No one wants to do this work. And you're also having these macro trends of, supply chain disruption, and we need to invest locally and invest domestically. So there's a bunch of kind of overarching macro trends as well as just domestic trends like complete labor shortage that are just driving these market trends, like robotics, for example.
It's interesting. So, do you? I because I'm in the U.S., I know that that's the case in our country. But is that the case also in other developed nations where there's a shortage of skilled labor to do some of this work?
So yeah, I like China's is facing a major demographic crisis. A lot of the up and coming generation doesn't want to work these jobs. The whole lying flat phenomenon in China kind of speaks to this, where like a lot of the younger generation, they don't want to do this work, right? And so what are you going to do if you have this like aging population, but you are historically the center of manufacturing, but your younger generations don't want to do this work? And so China, which has historically relied on like cheap labor, is seeking to do more implementation of all these automation technologies too, right? But they have a different cost equation because their labor is much cheaper than here, but everyone is feeling this. I think some countries, developing countries, are a little bit feeling it less because they have more people, but everyone is feeling it. Everybody is.
So, sounds like the trend is here to stay. For the benefit of our audience, we're recording this in June 2025. So, curious your thoughts on trends on bringing manufacturing home despite a lack of a skilled workforce. Do you think that's unique to this administration, or do you think that train has left the station and it'll be here for the foreseeable future?
Gosh, the thing is, I mean, there is this onshoring movement that has been brought on by this administration, the presidential administration. I don't know how. I mean, every day we kind of get a different, like, I guess, directive from the administration. So it's really hard for corporations to like invest in building a factory if we don't know, we don't have a long-term understanding of how the tariff situation will play out, right? That said, I would say that there has been generally an onshoring movement, apart from the whole, the presidential administration pushing these various like tariffs and all that stuff around. And that's just because it's not just there's a need to like maintain greater control over supply chain. That's partly brought on by like all the supply chain disruptions from the pandemic. And so companies are just trying to figure out smart and efficient ways to like make sure that their supply chains aren't get disrupted. And that onshoring is just a part of that kind of whole thought equation.
So, I think you just answered my next question, but I was going to ask if you find that there's any hedging mentality that finds its way into BMW's decision making for staying on the sidelines to see how things play out. But it sounds like no, it's not the case. There's a lot of conviction that this will continue to accelerate, this idea of onshore.
I can't speak to BMW. We're somewhat siloed from them. But whether it's BMW or any other automotive company, they're taking a hard look about this problem and they're trying to figure out what to do because automotive supply chains are global, right? So you might make something in Canada, but that part that you're making has touched China, has touched different countries, right? So everyone's thinking about it right now.
Separate but related, one of the questions that or feedback we've got is insights into how funds leverage AI within the back office, without revealing any trade secrets. Would love to know the extent that you guys have started to use the technology to, either support or automate any of your internal processes.
Oh yeah, so we are all we're looking at AI technology. We actually have I'm leading an AI project internally to see like what areas could BMW benefit from AI implementation. But within the team, we've also implemented like everyone gets ChatGPT, everyone gets like Firefly's Note Taker, kind of like basic level AI tools. And then I personally like I use ChatGPT all the time for diligence and like understanding a market. And also sometimes it's like writing a post on LinkedIn, right? So everything I do, even content-wise, I'm like, I try to use AI because the technology is just so amazing now. It could just automate everything. It should just be auto I actually, Christian, I don't know why you're talking to me right now. You should just be talking to an AI avatar version of myself, which probably would do way better and be a lot more charismatic. So maybe and talk to me in a year. We'll use AI avatar Sam.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, it's a good point. I've had this conversation with a bunch of people, and if you were to go full dystopian, you could make a case that, and I think I've heard Elon say this, is that at some point everyone will have a robot, and the robots will do everything. And depending on their access to materials, they'll make everything. So it just begs the question, what do we do? And I think it was Scott Adams. I was said something to the effect of, you're never going to be able to, you may be able to reproduce someone's personality, but he had an opinion that AI wouldn't be funny. And I think what he was calling out is just, the you can mimic human personality, but we're still going to be original in that regard. And maybe that's going to be where what makes us everyone unique in the future is who are we and what makes us who we are. And I think in that regard, you'll find that there's going to be even more so interest in better understanding people, what makes them tick. So yes, I've actually asked the question too, can I do an avatar for any of these things? But I don't know that I'd want to. Because they probably miss on picking up a lot of individual nuances, but I'm sure that'll improve over time too.
I think you're right. In the future, this is a conversation I've had many times. I think there will be a need for human authenticity, right? So you'll have like your AI products, but then you'll have, oh, this scarf is human made, it's handmade, right? And so in the same way we as humans today, we attribute like greater value to an original painting, we might have greater value to, oh, this is a handmade good by a human. I view ourselves as like humans in this economy where AI is taking over. they'll be like artisans, and you want an artisan's work, right? So yeah, we'll see, but I think AI is very creative, right? So what is creativity? It's all I would say iterations on patterns, and whether it's farm AI or humans, right? And nothing existed historically in a vacuum. So even bouts of human creativity were all based on past learnings. And so arguably creativity is overrated. And so I think it's really about authenticity in the future and social relationships, human connection. So it's good to be good with social skills, because I think that's where we're going to all be lacking in the future.
I like that. Authenticity is a great word. I think it's what I was looking for a moment ago. And if I wasn't, high five, because it is a good word.
Yeah, high five. There you go.
Sam, generally appreciate your time. Before we wrap up, I have a go-to question I enjoy asking our guests, and that is, if you had an op it's a retrospective. If you had a chance to go back to have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
I would say network earlier and believe in yourself, because you're gonna come across a lot of idiots and you're gonna think that they're smarter than you, but oftentimes they just talk. And so I think, I would say just believe in yourself, Sam, because you know what to do.
Anything in particular come to mind that maybe our audience would benefit hearing to say, oh yeah, I can relate.
Well, I would just say, Christian, I'm an aged woman. I'm 37. When I started out, it was hard, because of that. I think people judge me based on how I look like, how I sound like, and oftentimes there would be like that big guy in the room with a stick, and oftentimes that big guy in the stick with a big stick throwing it around in the room doesn't know much better than you. He just talks big and walks big, right? But I think, over time, once I got confident in myself, once I learned more about the industry, and once I knew how to communicate and hold my ground, I understand the difference between exterior facades and integrity and substance. And so I think over time, people you might feel or anyone might feel a little bit lost, but just keep going and believe in substance and follow substance.
Well, thank you for sharing and being candid. I appreciate that. I agree with you 100%. There's a tremendous amount of truth in what you described. I think it could be hard, right? Because you're earlier on and you don't have as much experience to realize that you're right. Just because someone talks a good talk doesn't necessarily mean they're not full of it, is a good way to say it, I think.
Oh yeah. The loudest people I've seen over like 10 years, they crashed and burned the hardest. So, always stick with good people and substance.
Good marker. Sam, before we wrap up, anyone in your network who you would like to see be a guest on the Innovators and Investors podcast?
Oh yeah, I do. But can I get back to you on that about recommendations?
100%. Not intended to call them out. It's just really more of a spirit of who's had an impact on you and, who would our audience benefit hearing from. But absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, just tell me the parameters and I'll shoot away some intros for you.
All right. Sam, if there are any members of our audience who want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn or email me at sam@bmwiventures.com.
Awesome. Sam, I genuinely appreciate your time. Really insightful. Obviously, you know your stuff. So thank you for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you, Christian. It was really a pleasure. And I look forward to the podcast and seeing it live. And then also my future AI avatar podcast. I'm looking forward to that too.
You'll be the first.
Okay.
Expectations set. You make yours, I'll make mine, and we'll see what happens. Although I think I saw the other day that someone published three avatars talking who like defaulted to like a crypto language so that they couldn't reveal what they were talking about. And I was like, I wonder if this is genuine or not, because if it is, oh my gosh, we got quite the future in store for us. But with that, Sam Wong, principal at BMW iVentures. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.